That was great, wasn't it? That was a great, really good insight from Chris.
It was good. We in this episode we had Chris Winterhoff. We spoke about a lot of great things, especially talking to things like talking to customers and getting to the reasons why they do things, do not do things, to inform your paid strategy and how you go about testing your ads. Which I thought was really interesting because that's what he does with his clients, which I've never seen before, like a freelance kind of paid person also doing the user research phase. So we
Yeah.
drilled into that. What else did we talk about?
His experience at Patch and differentiating a business, how a business can differentiate itself from the rest of the market. And here's really interesting anecdotes from time just before the pandemic where Patch the garden, it's not really a garden center, but it's like, plant delivery.
Yeah.
Online garden center was really taken off and scaling, and him as performance marketing manager. So I think lots of interesting stuff for people to learn about that. And for me, it's definitely the research. Like if you're conducting user research, if you're thinking about conducting user research, I think there's lots of takeaways on how to do that better from this episode.
Exactly. So yeah, hope you enjoy.
Go forth and listen. Here we go. Week two.
Week
Oh, is it
two.
week two? Yeah, week two. No, yeah, week two.
It will be when that comes out.
Will be week two. It will be week two. And we are talking with Chris. Chris, Christopher, Chrissy, Christoph. Because we'll find out when he joins. He's been a big supporter of the pod from early days. Lots of commenting and sharing
He's
and
been very active on the content so far, and reached out to come and chat, and we obliged. Is that the
you
word?
screened him. There is
We
somewhat of a requirement to
screened
come
him, make
on.
sure that there was some
No, he wasn't
good
a
talking
sales guy.
points.
No sales guys or girls allowed.
Oh, talking about LinkedIn, a little insider thing. I think I'm going too hard on the plugging of the pod in DMs because I
Yeah.
can see some people have received my message literally three times. Like
Uh-oh.
it's funny because the people. So I tell that story because that's a good like marketing whatever if you're in marketing or sales. So we are auto DMing my contacts on a daily basis using a tool, and there's a lot of people who ask me like, "Oh, this is automated. What are you using?" Da, da, da. So I always tell them we're using
You're not going to name
Wallaxy.
drop now. Oh, okay.
No, I'm gonna drop it. Yeah, it's fine. No worries. Maybe they'll sponsor the pod at some point.
Walaxy. I spoke over
Wallaxy
you as
with
you said
two
it.
A's, and yeah, it's out of control. I think it's a problem with like knowing which audience are receiving what and when. You can't really do that many exclusions and stuff. And now it's been like 7, 8 months. Well, a bit less that we've been doing that, like maybe 6 months we've been doing that on and off. But some cohorts of my follower base have received it three times. And some people just give you the thumbs up. Which means, it's the automated reply on LinkedIn, so I know they don't give a shit. They just like give a thumbs up. And some people are like, "Man, send it to me twice. Send it to me three times. I don't care about this podcast."
You should care.
But I always come back to these people because I'm like, first of all, thank you for telling me. Second of all, it's automated. And third, I'm sorry. So I always like give it like a nice little replies to these people because I'm like, I'm genuinely sorry because I don't want to like spam people like three times, ideally just one time.
And fourth, check out my podcast. It's called In Growth We Trust.
Shout out to Should do it again a fourth time. But it what's been great with this is like you can see the people who genuinely care, because when they do receive the message 2-3 times and they do like what we do, they always come back and be like, oh, by the way, I've received it a few times, really like it, I'm already following the pod, da, 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 yeah. You know, like they always like give like a nice touch. But yeah, that means I need to tweak that thing a little bit.
It's really hard to write a message that doesn't sound that I find it really, really difficult to write something that just doesn't sound like spam, because you would never just really message someone and say, hey, haven't seen you in ages and check out my thing in one message. You'd just like start with the niceties and then like in an hour's time
it's not like, oh, it's not for everybody. Yeah, it's not for everybody for sure. And I know most of the people who are connected with me or following me on LinkedIn do not know me. That's also why I don't really care that much, because I'm like, you know, worst case scenario, they won't read it or just give the thumbs up automated reply. Best case scenario, they'll read it. Maybe it'll spark like a new connection again, like, you know, like a relationship, which I'm happy to. Like, I'm always replying to the replies. So when they come back to the automated message, I always come back to them with like something personal. Mm-hmm. Which takes a lot of time. I showed you my DMs.
Yeah, sometimes,
like every couple of weeks, I get like hundreds. So it takes me hours to go through. But yeah, no, I thought it was a good story. Hey, Chris. That's
very good.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Chris.
How are you? Welcome, welcome.
I'm all right. I've survived the storm. How have you guys?
Yeah, same actually. Whereabouts are you?
I'm in London.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, it's been like battered the last couple of days, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty crazy.
Mm. Yeah. Are you? This is the first time I've seen you wearing a hat.
I normally wear hats. Yeah,
I've literally only ever seen you on your LinkedIn picture. You haven't got a hat on.
That's a good
point, because we're two bold guys, and I always wear hats in my photos everywhere, even on LinkedIn. But I decide not to, and then we see you and you're wearing a hat. And I'm like, yeah, okay.
So, you know what?
So is your policy no hats on professional pictures?
I don't know. I normally have no hats on client calls. That's my policy.
It's probably a professional way.
Yeah, but I've always like figured out, I think it's a good accessory. You know, when you're bald, you need to kind of figure out how to make that your advantage. Exactly. I haven't quite figured that out yet, so don't ask me for it.
If you were bald, a good advantage would be to have it, use it as a whiteboard in meetings.
Wow. Wow, this has, we're gonna start like this.
I think Jake needs to give us a demonstration, because I can't quite picture it.
I could definitely demonstrate it on my enormous receding patches. So, guys, I know part of the pain. I'll be there soon.
Oh man, I was gonna ask you where about in London are you based?
West. I'm based west, so like around Earl's Court, Kensington area.
Cool.
Oh, very nice. Cool, nice cool. Cheese. Is that a cheese plant? Or is it a philodendron?
No, it is. Yeah, yeah. Good knowledge. That is impressive.
It's like the one house plant I've ever purchased, I think.
Yeah, it looks a bit messy. I've had this one for 4 years, I think, and it's grown out of proportions. I had to add another moss pole on top, so this is like a 2 meter.
Oh, wow, plant. Really? Yeah. That's cool. Wow. Yeah, the moss pole is always like, it was like falling over in my bathroom in the end. Sacrifice it and throw them away.
You can't see it on here, but it's like leaning on the walls just ever so slightly.
Cheese plant is the plant I managed to kill a couple of years ago. I had it for 2 years, and then we went on holiday and then it died, and I looked into reviving it, like there are ways to like save it, and I was like, this is just too much work.
Doing growth we trust 2024, it's all about growing plants.
Yep. Growth of plants.
Well, welcome, Chris. Thank you for coming on. I hope you had a nice Christmas and New Year's. Kill it in 2023? Oh, no, shit, 2024. Not a good start, is it? No. Do you want to give us and the listeners like a brief overview of you? And then we can kick off with all the cool stuff we've got to talk about.
Yeah, sure. I think it is maybe good to start off with my obsession, which is differentiation. for businesses, as you guys are probably quite looking into that a lot as well for your clients, Jake, and obviously Nude, Johan. But yeah, it all started off, my first career was actually an investment bank. So I was on the sales side, and the bank was decent, but not the best, not your top tier bank, as you would imagine. So we had to like, and it's a commodity product that we were selling. So we were selling foreign exchange products. And so you can get the same product at any bank. So completely commodified. The only way we could stand out was really come up from a sales perspective and use the salespeople as the value added service that you could get via us. And yeah, it was always about kind of finding trade ideas and understanding what the market is looking for. But in finance, it's a little bit different. You always have to have this slightly different perspective, because if everyone knows of this trade idea, there's no trade to be made because there's no profit to be made. So you always need to come up with something a little bit different to try and entice your clients to trade with you. And I think that's where it really originated. So I was there for 3.5 years before dipping into the startup space, and kind of that obsession about how to be different, how to get just stand out from the crowd in business, then carried over as I entered the startup world. And worked at 4 different startups since then, and in-house, that is. And then recently, recently then went freelance, and now work with a handful of clients to kind of work on that differentiation aspect. But the core skill that I work at is that I do is basically paid marketing, so ads.
And interestingly, you were doing that for Patch during, I would imagine, their like massive growth period of the early days of the pandemic. And how was that?
That's the transition with the plants.
Yeah, look.
All right, you're too nice good. Work. Too good, guys. Really good. All right, go for it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, so the backdrop is, and this is where like your market is so, so important. And you guys know this, so I'm preaching to the converted, but massive expansion in the houseplant market at the time. And I say specifically houseplant, not outdoor plants, because we tried and tested outdoor plants as an offering as well. But our core customer group, and probably still is for them right now, but our core customer group at the time was millennials. So at the time, it was when I was there, think of 25 to 34-year-olds who were in their first flat and didn't have access to plants like their previous generation. So garden centers are generally located on the outskirts of town. And so for people who don't have cars, who maybe live in central places like Manchester or London, it's hard to get to those places. And then even if you do get to those places, it's super obscure. You've got all these weird Latin names of plants and you're like, how do I look after this? I've never owned a plant. So Patch really came in, simplified it massively. First of all, with the delivery aspect. I mean, you could always get deliveries on plants. I say always, but there were competitors in the space who were quite large who were already doing that, but they just weren't catering to that core demographic. And so Patch simplified the process, did away with the Latin names, gave them all nicknames basically we had. I mean, this guy is called Chaz. On the Patch site, you've got lots of different names for it, for other plants as well. And basically simplified the care process. So one of the big successes we had was a plant parenting course. So people who'd never owned a plant before could do this course and kind of go through this to the end of that and feel confident that they wouldn't be killing their plant. So that was one way we set that up and geared towards millennials. Another way that worked really well as well was to offer an unkillable range. I should say unkillable in quotation marks, but one of the key concerns
not for
was
me.
Yeah. Although, yeah, well, the Swiss cheese plant wasn't in that. It's actually quite fiddly to look after, but things like you've probably seen them, the sansevieras, the snake plants.
Super hard to kill. I've got one of those at the moment and it's flourishing, so
yeah they're super hard to kill. So that was part of the range, and this is kind of giving customers confidence that they would be able to hold on to them. And you notice that I haven't talked anything about paid ads, because it was a breeze in a way. We were doing really well. We were constrained, growth constrained, with regards to our delivery process, because we hand delivered plants within the Greater London area. So that meant that we could only market to Londoners. at the time. And then we worked very hard at making that nationwide, which we did a couple of months before the COVID pandemic. So it was a dream. But I left just at the start, so I didn't see that huge growth spurt that they had as everyone bought their home and garden furniture.
And that's a shame. And, yeah, we had Michael Lorenzo's on ages ago now, and he was at Bleach London, which was the hair dyeing company during that pandemic. There's so many businesses that were just like bubbling away, and then the pandemic came and it was like bang, perfect storm of like just crazy growth out of nowhere. So two things. One, interesting you said about Chaz, the cheese plant. The reason I said was that a philodendron plant is because what I bought from Patch during the pandemic was Phil, who was Phil the philodendron. So it was really interesting that obviously works. And it teach somebody something, teach somebody a way to remember something that makes them seem intelligent and you win. So on the subject of differentiation that you said at the start, for Patch that was very much, you know, get rid of all of the kind of crazy Latin stuff and simplify things down and really target into that very specific demographic that you identified at the start.
Yeah, for sure. And also have a much nicer brand. Like, I don't know if you're familiar, but there's like brands like Dobby's and I don't even know what the other garden center brands are, but they're just kind of stodgy. And so millennials, when they were buying plants, you didn't really feel like you were in the right store for you. Whereas obviously Patch was an online store, or is an online store, no physical locations, but it really felt like you were amongst like-minded people who were doing something for you, and you felt kind of comfortable in that space. So yeah, the brand was a huge, I mean, it was founded by an ex-brand consultant, so Freddie had done a really good work on that, but that was also a massive thing because it just fed through in how we communicated with people just felt great about buying with us, so that helped a lot as well.
I think there's something to at the time, like the idea of doing something from that's worked really well for like other categories and bringing like this like maybe non-obvious product into it, like e-commerce and like I don't know, things that were already happening in fashion and just like, you know, Shopify store, like those kind of concepts, and bringing plants into it, which was not really maybe happening at the time from the companies that were selling plants really at the time. Like it, you know, that kind of DTC approach to selling plants was very innovative at the time, so I can imagine that's part of the reason why it worked really well.
Definitely. And it's interesting, right, because we always talk about how powerful like brand is and building a brand and having your brand, but then also the kind of dichotomy between that's important, but also when you start a business, one of the last things you could focus too much attention on is like building a brand. You know, people spend so long coming out of a name and a logo and their color scheme, and they haven't even built the product yet. But then in that case, there must be, when your founder or a member of your founding team has like a strong branding background, is like an ex-brand consultant or an ex-head of brand or brand manager or whatever, so they can like come out the gate with a killer brand, that's got to give you like a massive early advantage, because it's just something that's done, leave to one side, and you've started with a fully formed brand out the gate.
Yeah, I'd probably argue against that being completely done, because you need to always keep on top of things. The market changes, perspectives change, so you just need to kind of be aware of that. But yeah, absolutely. I think it's, if the way I think about it is, and this is unfortunately one of those things where we've made commerce easier, e-commerce has made commerce easier, but it's also removed that human element. And the one key aspect that you have with bricks and mortar stores is that you talk to a person there. If you've got great staff, or the owner, the founder is in the store and kind of gives you a personal recommendation, that kind of personal relationship is really, really important. Like I just personally, I love shopping at my local pharmacist, like a mom and pop store, like there. I can see some family members in there, and it's great. Like I really enjoy going in there. They know me. I don't even have to, like, if there's a prescription, I don't even have to say my name. They know who I am. It's come in, I pick it up, I go, I shop there. I spend more than I would in, say, Boots or somewhere else, but it's just so personal. And brand is one of those things that, as e-commerce or any kind of online service, is really kind of needs to substitute for that. And it's really, really hard to do. But that's one way you can do it. So when you read through some of the, going back to Patch again, when you read through some of the website copy, it feels like you're talking to a person. It feels so fun, so normal. And I think like brands are really catching on to that now. But there was a time when it was just like you were reading so much corporate jargon and you were just like, that doesn't feel like a person. So
That's interesting. I was watching a video the other day of something random. I think it was on my TikTok feed or YouTube. And it was someone who, for some reason, was filming being in, it was in the US, but the equivalent of like a PC world in like the mid 80s. And they were asking the sales guy about the different, why like this Apple Mac thing, but maybe the first one that had come out versus like a Windows PC. And he was just so knowledgeable and he was like giving them all the details behind everything. And I was like, oh, it's such a shame because these days you don't really get that so much, you know, it's like, and I've been there myself, right? I've been employed in a shop, in a wine shop. I was like 18 and I never drank wine. And then someone comes in, oh, can you recommend me something to go with my beef bourguignon? And I'm like, just take a random guess. It's like we've lost that, going into a shop and having this personalized actual expert helping to kind of sell you things. So, yeah, I do really like that idea, actually, of being guided, especially with e-com where you've just got so much stuff. And I know at Net-a-Porter, a big thing, offer lots of luxury marketplaces, a big thing is the like curatedness. So talking that it's a curated selection, it's not just like 3 million pages of all the fashion that you can buy right now. It's like to some extent curated. But I don't think enough places put kind of an emphasis on that.
Yeah, that's true. Well, talking about the working in a shop, something I never spoke to, because also could be a downfall for this, is I had a summer job when I was really young, 17, 18, at the big DIY shop called Leroy Merlin in France. Really big in, I don't know in other countries if they have it in other countries, but it's really big in France. And I was in charge of on the floor sales guy in the plumbing section. I'd never done any anything, but I was giving the best experience to every customer who was asking me questions about their plumbing projects and what parts they needed to buy. They would buy the things I would tell them, and it was a really nice story, but I had no idea what I was doing.
It doesn't sound like you were getting a very good experience to them when they got home and had the wrong thing.
Oh yeah, no. So that was they definitely fucked when they were going home. But at the point of talking to me, it was brilliant.
The boiler room of plumbing supplies. Just be a smarmy guy. Sell them anything, and they get home and realize it's all shit.
I think I was really charming, but I have no idea. I
hope that's not the kind of marketing you still practice to this day, Johan.
Who knows?
So Chris, with the fractional stuff you do now and the consulting you do now, you focus that around differentiation, or that is kind of a subset of the things that you do? Or like if you could choose to do of all of your future gigs, is that where you'd want that to kind of be?
Yeah, so I've come from a perspective of I've been ahead of growth, I've been ahead of marketing, so I've had that generalist approach, and now it's, I think, one of those things when you're freelancing, contracting, kind of work, doing agency type work, you do kind of need to rein that back in and focus on one specific area. So I focus on paid ads, so the ads management side, but you guys also know that that's increasingly automated, especially my probably core platform is Meta. So the only thing that really makes a big difference, so there are some smaller things, but the biggest difference is creative. So and then it comes, I do a lot of first principles thinking, so try and go back to the actual basics of everything, and what are people there to do on Facebook or Instagram, or I guess Threads soon as well. They are there to be entertained, maybe to learn a little bit, and so kind of just reverse engineering creative to stand out amongst all the organic content and all the other ads as well. So that element of, and I think this is that something that is going to become more prevalent. I've seen little shoots of it, but I don't think it's quite as common as it is, as it should be really, is kind of informing creative with research. So everyone talks about understanding customers and talking to customers, but what does that actually mean? And to me, the only answer it really is kind of talking to customers and doing customer research interviews. But not only that, also talking to non-customers, because those are often people who maybe you've marketed to and missed out on. So they're not part of your core customer group currently, but they could be. So it could be an adjacent market that you enter. So I do the paid stuff and what feeds the performance on the paid side of things. And when I say paid, I mean basically paid social at this stage, is doing that customer research and talking to customers and non-customers and trying to extract insights on their perspectives of the market. So often you'll find you will be, I mean, Johan Nude has probably got umpteen different banks that they could be competing against, but you're focusing on first-time buyers. And so how does the typical first-time buyer see the market? Do they see all these banks as competitors? Do they see investment products as competitors? So like stock markets and so on, because they're trying to save up and invest for their first deposit. And it's where does that competing solution mapping fall into place? And that's really trying to understand, okay, there might be different, I hate the word, but personas in a way of customers who see things slightly differently. And how can you then market your product to the right core customer that will then end up becoming your customer? I've said a lot of jargon here, and I'm sorry, it's probably a little bit removed, but basically it's just trying to get research, extracting insights, feeding that into a creative. So your messaging and of course there's creative formats out there, and kind of applying that to your company, and then that's the engine that drives your growth by, if it's via paid social.
Well, you said something interesting here. So what you, when you work with your clients now, you offer those two things, so the ads management and the customer research. And that's something that I don't think we spoke about it in the podcast that way before, especially from a paid kind of profile like you. So maybe let's dive into that bit more. Like, how do you, like, what frameworks do you use to actually extract the information from the customers and the non-customers, and what does it look like on the other side when you're done?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So my favorite question, and people ask this a lot, if you're in the customer research space, people say, like, oh, what's the best question to ask customers? And that's kind of, it's a bit of a silly question, because it's not about the questions. It's about kind of listening and kind of responding to what's being said. So, but the best, if I did have to answer that question, the first thing I always ask is, kind of go very broad. So if we think about, again, Nude possibly, that I would ask a question like, tell me about your personal finances. What are they like right now? And then you kind of get them very broad, get a very broad answer, and you kind of understand how they view things. Are they anxious? Are they confident? Why? And then you kind of drill down, okay, they're anxious because they can't save enough. They're concerned they can never afford a place, but maybe they're not even thinking about a place. Maybe they're thinking about a car that they want to buy, or maybe they're thinking about their pension. So kind of going wide, and that just gives you a little bit of information about their perception of their own personal finance. So if we just left it at that, you could kind of extract an insight and say, okay, should we do more positive or more negative marketing? So what I mean by that is, should we say, hey, we've got the product for you, you can save up in X amount of years, awesome. Like a kind of more positive slant. I'm sure copywriters can think of something a little bit more snazzy than that. But on the negative side, you could say like, hey, it's harder and harder to own a place. Nude gives you the option to do it sooner than you may have thought. And that's kind of that negative slant. But going back to that first question, so going broad gives you unprompted, unvarnished responses to how they view the market, and then that gives you the time to kind of drill down and understand different aspects. So I can't really give you a framework as such as to how I would tackle that, because it really depends on how they go about answering that question. But it's just kind of having to think on your feet. And I would have, if I was doing this in a custom interview, I would have a sort of 10-15 questions that I could ask afterwards. And so some of those questions might already be answered, and I want to drill down a little bit further into some of the responses. But that's basically one aspect. There's also looking at, and this is also not a framework, but hopefully paints a bit of a picture, because it's very messy, it's super messy. And the first like three or four interviews that I normally do are complete chaos. And I don't really know what I'm doing. I feel super, not really confident in what I'm doing. And there's always a little bit of niggling doubt. But after those four interviews, you start to see patterns emerge. And then you can start reading between the lines of the answers. Like, what haven't they mentioned? Oh, this one person didn't even talk about this at all. Why did that not happen? And then you sometimes go back into the transcripts and try and understand that. Sometimes you don't have an answer. And so you just in the fifth interview, then you ask, you try and drill into a hypothesis that you start forming. And so it's like a cloud, and the cloud kind of clears, but there's still some hidden areas. And basically by interview 7 or 8, you should have a pretty clear picture. And so the outputs that you get from that are, I'll give you an example. I was speaking to a, I was actually partnering with an agency on this one here, but we were speaking to a credit builder. There are these apps, and they work in the credit building space where you can increase your credit score. And one of the really interesting answers from one of the participants, they were not a customer, this was a non-custom interview, was that they would never buy or never do engage with a financial product if they saw that ad on TikTok. And so then you're like thinking, well, okay, that makes sense. It's maybe the digital space is too kind of newfangled. There's a lot of scams and other things going around, and they're feeling a bit insecure. So one of the ideas that for ad creatives that we came up with were these, you've seen these as well, these like fake digital billboards. For the client, like cost constraints were a problem. So they couldn't just do a massive out of home campaign. So you can create these like digitally rendered billboards and kind of use them on digital channels to kind of showcase that you are out there, that you are marketing in the real world, although it's maybe slightly dubious. But that was one of the ideas that came out of that interview that they could then apply to try and overcome that concern about just seeing ads on TikTok.
That's interesting. There's a few things to go into on that. Do you think it's better to do, so you're going to do 50 user interviews, and the follow-up to this question is going to be, how many do you start with? But let's say you're going to do 50. Is it better to do, just nail through 50 in a day, or batch them up? So in between the first 10, you can listen to them and you can say, okay, now we need to kind of change tact and dig in a bit more into this kind of question. So at the end of those 50, you've had a bit more of a range of questioning. So that's question one. And then question two, like, how do you decide how many to do in each batch?
Yeah, I probably would never do 50. That's a bit overkill. my interviews, I tend to do them for about an hour. So they're quite long, but it because I go really broad at the start, it does mean that you just need a bit more time. I know people who do it 25, 30 minutes. And to me, there's not enough. You can't really go deep enough to get the insights that you really need to get to. So I'd probably go for about 10. 10 is a good number. You can do more, you can do 15, but you start seeing diminishing returns once you kind of hit that 10-ish number, sometimes a bit earlier. Sometimes you need to do a few more. And in practice, I mean, yeah, sure, you could bash 10 interviews out in a day and do like a 12-hour day possibly, but it's really tough because you're actively listening. You're not doing the talking, you're actively listening to them. You're trying to think whilst you're on the call, you're trying to think, what are they actually saying? What is interesting here? What can I dig into? Because I rarely hop onto another call with that same person. Because then you've already influenced them a little bit. And I try to kind of keep that very... I try to not even say the company I'm working with when I do these interviews, because I don't want to influence them. But yeah, so basically, I try and do... I mean, over the course of 2 weeks, you can do 10. I think that's fair. You can do it shorter as well, but it does give you time to think, because then you collect. After your first couple of interviews, I mentioned those three or four interviews, you start to see those pictures emerge, and then you might have to refine your questions entirely and kind of refocus the research. So yeah, little batches is kind of great, because you do need time to process and just to sit back and see what has been said, what hasn't been said. And also you as an interviewer are performing as well. So often on your first couple of interviews, you miss questions and you think, I should have asked them this. And so you learn yourself in each of these projects, you learn what questions are good, what questions are not so good, and as you kind of progress, it's kind of, it's an iterative process basically. Mm. So yeah, 100% batches work well, and then reassessing after each batch. But in practice, interview recruitment is super hard, and so recruiting the right candidates, you're dictated by when they have the time and how many candidates you can find. So in practice, it doesn't normally work that way anyway. So you don't have them all bunched up in one day.
That's true. And when do you recommend doing this phase? Because we know, like, depending on the size of the company, especially for like startup, like, speed is of the essence. Like, do you start implementing some of the learning straight away as you're going through the interviews? Do you wait until you've finished it all, do the analysis, and then move into the creative phase? Like, how does it, where does it sit in the timelines?
Yeah, it depends a little bit on the client, basically. You can start implementing things straight away. Sometimes there's something super obvious, and you can start implementing straight away. I prefer to kind of take everything back first, and the process is not that long. So I know you're talking a couple of weeks here in terms of timeframes of like starting the interviews, maybe having finished that first analysis and that insight, have that insight extraction being done. So that might be 2 or 3 weeks from start to finish. So it's not really that long, but some of these things you can start testing. So if they're already running marketing, so if it's like an early stage company and they already start running marketing, you can start feeding them little bits that they can start testing. Because the whole process about research, about this research side and the interviews, is that it's qualitative. So you're not going to cover the whole market. You're going to have a lot of bias in there. You then need to solidify that. Those hypotheses that you form and those insights need to be confirmed with actual quantitative stuff. So that's when you run the ads. You create a testing schedule of the different creators or different messages. The byproduct is you can also run different landing pages, customize the landing pages according to the test. So test the messaging as well. So ideally you kind of hold them all and test them all at once to make sure that you've, and you separate the tests into different factors. So you know, okay, this message works really well on the ads and on the landing page. There's a high conversion rate, so that's great. I'd recommend kind of holding them back, because it doesn't take too long to kind of get to the insight and to the execution side of things. But there's obviously also the ad creation process, where sometimes it might take a while for them to create it, or the landing pages might have hard-coded copy on there, which is not ideal. So you might need to use a landing page tool or some dev work needs to be done there to enable the testing. So yeah.
Okay. Do you have a preference when somebody asks you what to use for A/B testing? Let's just keep it simple and say a website. Google Optimize has gone these days, and there's a few other competitors out there. Some of them are quite expensive. I don't know if anyone's listening, they want a recommendation, if you would have one.
I think it's a call for sponsorship if anyone wants a podcast.
So.
But I've used VWO. I haven't used that many tools, to be honest. So it was just Google Optimize at the time, but VWO I've used has worked quite well, and they've got a generous free plan as well. So I can't remember what the thresholds are, but you can get away.
Well, the letters you just said, is it VWL?
VWO, yeah.
VWO, okay.
Correct.
Nice.
Okay, so then that's all clear for users that are clicking, they're coming through, you're doing your testing. How do you find those potential adjacent users, or just the users that don't click, to understand what it is that would have made them come through to the product in the first place?
Yeah, it's quite hard. I think there's a few tools out there.
$1 million question.
Yeah. I mean, there's two options. One is manual recruitment, and I'm happy to go into some of the things that I do there. And another one is you can use like a service for, they basically recruit interviews for you.
Yeah.
Now the trade-off here is cost, basically. You can get them to do it. They do a lot of the filtering. You give them criteria of, hey, this, the age range, income brackets, locations, if your B2B job titles, other things like that. In fact, the B2B space is much easier to recruit for because you use one of these services and they just go out. So that's one thing. And that can work quite well. The other thing is just doing manual research and doing manual reach out, to be honest. So LinkedIn is great, especially on B2B, because you know who roughly who the market is. Sometimes you've got multiple personas you need to consider, where there's not just one buyer, but you need to kind of think about the CTO, think about possibly HR. If it's an HR tool, there might be an IT person who needs to approve things. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but that can be a little bit complicated. But if you're talking about B2C, so if it's like a mass market product, Facebook groups, Reddit, you can kind of do. You can also go into subreddits and kind of message DM people directly. It's a bit frowned upon, to be honest, but it does work. You can get people in there, especially if you do like a nice post and introduce, add value basically, and then refer to that value in your outreach. Yeah. Friends and family is a really good one as well. So yeah, it's not easy when you start getting into like the niches. Like if you're doing luxury products and you absolutely need to have someone who's got a high income or high disposable kind of cash outlay, mm-hmm. as in people who mm-hmm. just generally shop like high value goods, that can be quite tough. And then I'd probably say just save yourself the time and effort and just go for a specialist service who can recruit those people for you.
And ever recruitment through ads, or not suggested?
I've not done that, to be honest. I think it could work. I've personally not done that.
I'd be interested to know what people think. I mean, a lot of people probably think that's a scam.
Yeah,
you can obviously target quite well.
Yeah, if you're clever with your creative, it could be quite cheap, to be honest. Maybe a lot of non-qualified leads, but the lead generation, you know, type ads, yeah, they could work quite well. You know.
Yeah, the key thing for any recruitment is to always have a screening questionnaire. So you're not just going to, and you might have to refine that as well. I've had many processes where we had like 5 to 10 questions on a screening questionnaire. And then we've had to ditch the entire batch of people who signed up because we realized we asked something incorrect or it was misunderstood. Yeah. And that in a way is research as well, because you're having to phrase it a certain way, referring back to the credit building research piece. We asked a question around how about credit scores and why people thought their credit scores were whatever they'd answered in a previous question, and people didn't understand that follow-on question. So it told us that they didn't understand credit scores that well, but also we phrased it in a way that was perhaps a little bit confusing. So we had to ditch an entire batch and kind of rephrase that question to get better quality answers.
To be honest, on the on getting people to answer, like it's a bit different when you try and get them to then talk to them. Because then there's like a low conversion rate. There's probably a lot of filtering to do. But when you just need to get people to answer a few questions, I would argue that some of the companies you can pay for those leads are probably using Meta ads and, you know, have lists that they bought from other places, etc. So could potentially do it yourself. But I've actually done some costing on that front like recently, and I was surprised of the cost just to get people to answer surveys. It's not that expensive anymore. I don't know if it used to be more expensive, but it was like £1, £1.50 per completed survey, and I'm like, can I beat that with a Meta ad on lead generation? Probably not. So they are actually competitive. I think it depends on what you need. If you actually need to talk to people, it gets more expensive. That's my guess, but I haven't done that for a while.
On that point, yo, we recently for a client we ran some surveys. They were it wasn't necessarily from a customer research standpoint, although it did. There was obviously a lot that we learned from that, but it was more like specific for their product without going into the intimate detail of it. And we ran ads for that on social because it was kind of like a value add. You do the survey and you get, you know, personality score or something if you want to distill it down to that. And we did get them for about £1, £1.50. But the problem is, because the person had come through an ad, this is where I kind of posed the question initially, in terms of the contact details, it was just spam. The amount of like mickeymouse@gmail.com we had in there was just rendered lots of it useless for actually like follow-up questions. So I guess that's probably, you know, even if you can get it for cheap, if you can get people in the door for the cheap that fill out the screener questions, are they really going to give you legit contact details, or are they just coming in for whatever it was that you like promised that you were going to give somebody, you know, the prize or whatever it is for doing the survey?
Yeah, that's true.
So we do, so
go on.
Just to answer that question from like, it's, I think these always have to be incentivized, and you incentivize them by, to get more truthful answers. You say like, hey, this is a screening questionnaire. We'd love to do some have some conversations afterwards. We don't call it interviews, but conversations. And then you say like, there's a, I don't know, you might get a, depending on who you're targeting, but £30 Amazon voucher at the end of it if we pick you. And then you incentivize people to give you the right contact details, and some of that data you can get on the pre-screening questionnaire as well can also be supplied to the client. Yes. Because sometimes there's some interesting insights there, although then you still need to kind of qualify that a little bit with some of the interviews.
Really good. There's a concept that we haven't spoke about yet, no, looking at the time, but a concept that you're still working on a name for, and I think we're leading to it, but the performance creative marketer concept. Do you want to talk, should we talk about that a little bit, and what you have in mind for this, and what you do with your clients at the moment? And
so I think this creative performance marketer, I think that's going to be a new breed of marketer that's going to come out, because it used to be, I mean, you guys are pretty clued up on the paid space. It used to be that there were lots of different hacks and lots of different audience targeting you could do on Meta specifically, where you could kind of gain an edge over your competitors. And now with everything being more automated, like Advantage Shopping Plus is kind of taking over. There's other things in the works here, but basically your audience targeting is AI. And AI determines where your ads run. So the key edge that you can have is on the creative side. So I see the breed of performance marketers who've kind of used to this world of hacking or audience targeting, they're kind of moving away from that. And they need to move towards creative as driving that creative component of your paid social campaigns. And I think this is kind of going back to what was the Mad Men era in the like 60s and 50s, 60s, and possibly even 70s, where you're seeing, I don't know if you guys have watched Mad Men, series.
A few times.
It's fun. But it that kind of feels like it's coming back, where back then you would just run TV ads. And sure, you could select different TV slots, but it was a creative that drove the performance more than anything, and a good creative made or broke a campaign. And so I think that's coming back now, where people who are on the digital side, very analytical, very understand the ins and outs, and that is not going to change, but that's not where the edge is. So I think the edge is now moving towards this creative aspect. And I'm not saying these people will turn into designers and create those themselves, but they will brief designers. They'll write the creative briefs using insights from wherever they've gathered them to kind of drive that creative angle. So I think that's what's going to come more and more. And I see that already in some bits, but especially in larger companies where everything's quite siloed, it hasn't happened yet. But on the startup side, you're seeing more creative emphasis being put on performance marketing. And I think that's going to continue to kind of roll out over the coming years.
Definitely.
It's also that you kind of fall into, I found myself falling into a trap where you want your design team, let's say they're not specifically a marketing team design resource, they're a resource that's shared across departments, and you feel like they can see what you can see from the performance data, or, you know, you give them a very loose brief around iterate on this theme because this is the theme that's working well for us. And they come back and they're like, I really need more of a brief for this thing, because the kind of world that they work in is not necessarily always, not all of them, but not necessarily just using their initiative. It's like they get a brief and they use their creative skills to execute that brief. So I definitely see that there is a world where someone who can dig into the numbers and really understand what, add another layer onto that, which is the creative layer, which is what would the iteration be, and then write the brief and then get it created. Like you said, Chris, not actually doing the work themselves, but being able to go to that level where a designer can just take that and go, yeah, that's clear, that makes sense, I'm going to make that, rather than come back to you and say, oh, I don't quite understand the brief, or can you show me an example of the creator that worked, or can you tell me what it was that the user clicked on. So it definitely makes sense to me that is somewhere where a lot of people could start specializing.
Yeah. And it's also...
Go for it.
I was going to say there's also the... One thing we haven't really talked about, there's also more of a storytelling aspect as well that kind of comes out. It's not just kind of using the data and using the insights, but the people I've seen that do this really well, they have that storytelling ability and understand what creates a really good story. So I could say, hey, okay, hook rate is really important, hold rate is really important, and obviously click-through rate and conversion rate are really important. And those are like different data points that you measure, but that doesn't really tell you the angle that you're approaching on the storytelling side. And so I think there's also that aspect of kind of crafting a story that can shine through the creatives. And that sounds super vague. What do I mean by that? But it's kind of that hook. What informs a hook rate? What holds people? Could it be an interesting visual? Yeah, sure, that works, but it's kind of like a hack. How do you, if you have an opener on the ad, what's the opener that will drive curiosity for them to watch the rest of the 10, 15, 20 second ad? And it's that kind of, how can you use the brand that you're working for, form an interesting hook that creates a question that will drive people to watch, that will then also, going back to the people who initially pick up that story, that'll also call out to the right people who can turn into customers. So because creative is driving it, loads of us are running ads that are probably driving the wrong type of person to take an interest in our products. And I think there's calling out the way you form that hook to drive that customer that's just right in your target demographic or target customer group that is then most likely to convert at the last stage and become a customer. So I think that storytelling angle of driving that customer is also part of this creative performance marketer who can understand that and kind of feel and basically become a customer expert. That's basically what it is.
Yeah.
And use data to prove that.
And you know, as you were talking, I was trying to make a parallel with some of the work we've been doing at Nude, which is working with like creators. They're not even influencers, just people who make like great content, good storytelling. You know, they've got that thing for the hook. They know how to tell something in a certain way. And what I like to do with them is give them like the very basic nature of what the product does. And everything that I was thinking about, everything you spoke about in terms of asking customers questions and like drilling down, like the whys and asking why a few times until you get to the nitty gritty. Like maybe there's a way to do that with creators where they actually do that in the actual storytelling. You know, like they're drilling down in the story, they're really like going to the, what's the word? Like the pure, like the instinctive reason, the truth as to like why they would use your product. Or maybe they're using your product, but they might not do that. But that might convince the larger group that are like them to then do it. But you could do that straight into the creative. Maybe there's a way to like shortcut this, and it's like you do the interview as the creative. Sorry, bumped into my mic. As the creative, and then put that into the ads directly.
I'm sure you could come up with like an extremely convoluted like flowchart of they see this ad and they click, and then they see these 10, and they're all different they're all effectively asking different questions, and then depending on what they click, you kind of work out that way. Could be interesting. Seems like one of those things where you'd like build it in Excel and it would look wicked, and then you'd run it and it'd be like an absolute nightmare to keep on top of. Mm. But that is very interesting. And everything that we've just said, or that you guys have just said, just brings us full circle back to understanding the customer, right? Because if you want to tell the story that hooks them in, you have to understand what they're looking for. And something that you might have both seen, but something that like nailed this point really well for me when I saw it a long time ago, was Clay Christensen, who was with Bob Ariosto. They kind of come up with the Jobs to be Done framework, and he gives a speech and he talks about this time he was consulting for McDonald's and they wanted to sell more milkshakes. And I'm going to steal the story right down, but it's definitely worth going and watching that. They basically did a load of customer research and they brought out a load of new flavors, and it turned out that it didn't increase sales at all. So then Clay went in and he spent time understanding and really looking at what people were buying and then interviewing those customers, and it turned out that it wasn't that people were buying a milkshake because they just wanted something to drink and it was competing with a Pepsi. It was the thickness of the milkshake meant that it lasted longer, it filled them up till lunchtime. It was the perfect thing to drink in their car versus a banana, because a banana was difficult to eat while you're driving, whereas a milkshake you can just suck up, it's the same consistency as a banana. So it turned out that the customer's job to be done wasn't just getting a milkshake, it was being full up but having something that they could drink whilst driving. So the competing product was actually a banana or a Mars bar, and then they kind of lent into that and they made the milkshake thicker so it lasted longer, and that's how they managed to increase sales x times. So I think that's a great example of like you really don't know what the customer is using your product for unless you really go into that detail.
Yeah, no one likes a runny milkshake.
No. Or the milkshake machines are barely ever working whenever I go to McDonald's, so that's the most annoying thing. Chris, we've kind of come up against it. That went super quickly. I hope we covered everything that you kind of wanted to. If there's anything you want to touch on in the last few minutes, feel free. Otherwise, that was brilliant.
I think we covered it. Yeah, it's interesting. I think AI obviously is changing things, but you only read about these in case studies or like articles about other industries, but here I think we're live seeing these changes happen, and it's one of those things where the story is yet to be written.
But I think some of the things you mentioned is also like going back to like human interaction and understanding people. Yes, you can use AI to help you maybe distill what's been said, and maybe you use that for transcripts and things like that, but spending time talking to people and asking them like the real reasons why they do things or do not do things, I don't think it's gonna go away anytime soon. So
human motivations don't change, do they? It's always status that people want. There's always comfort. There's certain desires that don't go away, and so if you understand those and how to activate those, then status, you'll probably have a job for life.
All that.
Well, if someone's listening and their human interaction is to see more of you, Chris, and the great content that you put out, I meant to dig into that. Your new style of content of like the drawing stuff is really cool. So, where can people find you? How would you like people to find you if they want to?
Yeah, thank you. It's basically LinkedIn. That's the only place I post. I do have a blog, but I don't really keep active on that. But LinkedIn, if you look up my name, Chris Winterhoff on LinkedIn, add me. I promise I'll add most people back, although if you're a creep, maybe not. But
or a recruiter.
I definitely will add recruiters. Recruiters are interesting lead gen sources for freelancers.
Okay. Cool.
But yeah, no, just on LinkedIn.
Nice.
Brilliant.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for having me.